succession number 28528, reel 4.
Attorney Paulson, reel 4.
When I had joined up with the company, I was pleased to see the sight, the encouraging sight, of large numbers of Valentine and Crusader tanks lined up in battle orders. We were told to go into reserve behind the next hill, which was now strongly held by a whole battalion of infantry. So we took our positions without any thought, with such strength in front of us, that we would be rapidly in action again. At first, there were no problems, occasional fire in the distance, but during the day that got louder and louder and nearer, and by night time we suddenly saw tracer bullets and tracer shells crisscrossing the hill in front, and the sound of tanks coming near and scene obviously of tanks or trucks blazing. So I was sent forward on my own to do a reconnaissance and see what was happening. I went forward to the crest, either crawling or running in short distance, passing a tank which I thought was very courageous, as it seemed to be motoring on despite being on fire. I then suddenly realized that this was an illusion. It was merely the wind making the flames scream and giving the impression of motoring on when it was actually knocked out and still. After that, I went with even greater caution to the crest and looked down on a sight of total confusion. There were burning trucks, burning tanks, and an unhappy mix of prisoners, large numbers of whom had been taken. Later, it was to my surprise that none of them actually made it their way back to join us, when one of the knocked out tank crews managed to change into Arab and make his way back to join us. But for the moment, all we could do was to prepare for what we expected would be a massive attack the following day. Early in the night, we had, of course, joined with the rest of the companies, and one which was situated near the road found a tank motoring so close to their slip trench that the corporal got up and blasted the tank commander, who was well out of his turret. He was therefore a bit surprised to be told to put his hands up, as he hadn't noticed the German markings on the tank. Happily, however, the tank had parked only a few yards from one of our 25-pounder field guns, which promptly shelled it and knocked it out. Thereafter, the night was quiet, but early the next morning, a motorcycle came down. It did have a Red Cross insignia on it, but from somewhere the shout went up, "He's come to inspect our positions." And at that, the field gun fired again, and this time the shell splinters killed the crew, though leaving the motorcycle relatively undamaged to be annexed later. Whether this was another German trick or seemed likely, since there were no casualties to remember, I know not, but after what they had done in overrunning the company in front, it was their own fault if that was a genuine Red Cross motorcycle. The day then was very anxious, of course, where we all were. We occasionally saw tanks maneuvering on the crest. We were occasionally shelled, which made me realize that that old saying that you never hear the shell that kills you can be quite wrong, because I heard one coming and ducked down to the bottom of my fortunately well-dug slip trench, and the shell landed on the parapet, blasting my eardrums and breaking to pieces my Bren gun, to leave me short of defensive weapons at the time. But there were, I counted on our right, the remains of our tanks, which regrettably were only 17 or so Valentines and Crusaders, drawn up in battle formation. We were a little relieved during the day when the anti-tank platoon drove up under Ian Blacker with the latest anti-tank guns just delivered, which had the code word of pheasants, but which were in fact 17-pounder guns, the first anti-tank guns we had which were any match for the Germans' amazing 88mm guns. The guns were sighted in an oppressive silence, and we waited for the expected onrush, and certainly the Germans could have overrun us with no trouble at all had it not been for or certainly not before the anti-tank guns were in position. Even then, it would have probably been an easy effort for them. So I was sent forward again with a small patrol the next morning to find out what in fact was happening as we ceased even to see tanks manoeuvring. To my surprise, I found the whole place deserted on the other side of the hill. There were still knocked out tanks, knocked out trucks, and a general litter and confusion, but of the Germans there was no sign. This was amazing to us, and it was only after the war that we read about it and discovered that it was not any fear of what lay ahead of them that had stopped the Germans, but of the threat being now posed on the Germans by Montgomery's advance on the Marrieth line. Both Rommel and Kesselring had discussed the matter and decided that they'd already accomplished more than they had dreamed possible in this attack, and it was time to break it off and do an equivalent preemptive strike against Montgomery while he was still trying to get his forces in order for an attack on the Marrieth line. Happily, they were already too late. A typical Monty defensive web had been spun based on Medellin, and with the massive help of 450 anti-tank guns, including some of these pheasants, so-called. So when the Germans did attack, they had something over 50 tanks knocked out, suffered many casualties, while Monty's forces lost no tanks or guns and had very few casualties. So their attempt to preempt his attack merely made them all the more vulnerable when the real attack started on the Marrieth line. For us, that was a prelude to our second big battle. Again, this is something about which I wrote in a letter home, so it would be best to record it exactly as I told it. Unknown to us, a new battle was being planned elsewhere. The 8th Army had broken through at Marrieth, and a drive to the coast to cut off the Axis retreat was in store for 1st Army. The advance was to be hampered, its success limited, and its costs to our battalion unnecessarily high because of a second abject failure by the inexperienced Americans. For the second time, we were the ones to suffer as they learnt the hard lessons of war. What followed is no 60-year-old memory, but a letter written home a few days after the event, while it was still all too fresh in my mind. This was it. A motorcycle in the night was again the herald of trouble. It was that sound of a racing engine, which was swiftly followed once again by my summons for orders. Once more by my summons for orders by the company commander. and the launching into my first major attack. Initially, my instructions were simply to drive ahead and prepare a dispersal area at distant El Ala as prelude to the battle. That was the starting point of another letter written home at the time. We wait impatiently at the crossroads. Behind us, the dawn light is beginning to soften the dark mass of Jebel Trotsa. From the forest of Kesera, where we are, Trotsa seems to dominate the landscape, towering up in the distance, menacing, and giving us the impression of always being overlooked and spied on. Behind it lies another range of hills, broken by the Fondouk Gap, with the flat plains stretching past Karawan and Sousse to the sea. We can guess what we are going to do, and that this will be our first really big attack. The division is to be used as a complete division for the first time. Most of it has moved up already, lumbering past us in the darkness to be hidden in the woods. But our battalion has not yet completed its 150-mile drive, and we've become impatient, watching the growing light and feeling the all-seeing eye of Trotsa frowning down on us. A column of dust approaches, and soon the leading trucks emerge, just in time to be guided to concealment in the trees. Later we get orders. The enemy is holding Pichon and the hills on either side of the gap, with five battalions of infantry, all German or Austrian. Their outposts have been driven off Trotsa during the night. We are to move to a concentration area at El Ala tonight, and at dawn the attack is to begin. The hills on either side of the gap are to be stormed by British and American infantry, ascended through a huge minefield covering the 700-yard gap, and then we are to pass through into the plain and drive for the coast, cutting off what we can of Rommel's troops, now in full retreat. In the early afternoon, I go off with the other company seconds in command to reconnoitre our area. The road to El Ala is terrible, with bad surface, sharp turns, precipitous sides, and makeshift crossings of rivers. All this the whole division still have to negotiate in the dark without lights. Two Churchill tanks have already plunged over the sheer drop and lie drunkenly on their sides. All along the road are signs of previous fighting. Shell holes, French wrecked tanks, looking absurdly out of place and date, and here and there an old Valentine with its little two-pounder gun we call a pea shooter. The El Ala crossroads are being shelled as we turn off there, but no one is hit. Our area is down a sandy track in a cactus grove just by El Ala, right beneath Trotsa, which rises sheer from the plain in awesome shapes and heights. The wind is blowing and dust whips into our eyes as we sit and wait. Darkness comes suddenly and a chill, freezing cold. I try to get some sleep, but a great blaze springs up nearby as a truck catches fire, no doubt from a rifleman who doesn't realize that the fumes from a petrol can are just as likely to be lighted by a cigarette as the can itself. The fire is soon out and we go back. It is getting on for midnight when the leading trucks arrive, but in the dark they get hopelessly bogged in the sand. Nothing can pass, and the rest of the night is hectic confusion, turning the division round, finding new areas in the dark, sorting units out and getting them under cover. We are easily within range of enemy guns, and by a prodigious effort everything is hidden before dawn's revealing light. German reconnaissance planes come over. No one fires. The attack has been put off a day as the infantry and guns could not get in position in time. The day passes quickly with intermittent shelling. Final preparations are made, final orders issued. At 04:30 we wait to hear the guns. The darkness of the night is seared with continuous flashes. Soon we hear distant machine gun fire, like a patter of raindrops. Tracers, green, yellow and red, begin to flash across the sky, seeming at this distance to describe slow, graceful arcs. Dawn breaks and our barrage increases. The jeep parks near us with a sign P on it. This is Phantom, or the unit which communicates information direct to Corps or Army. We go over to watch the progress of the attack on the officer's map. Our regimental group is to be the first to go after the infantry have gained their objectives. On the left, the Hampshires and the French Gooms, supported by Churchill tanks, are making wonderful progress. They've advanced several miles and must have fought with great dash and skill. The American Arrow has not started to move, though the whole division should have started to attack the hills on the right. Apparently they're waiting for breakfast or something. The sun gets higher, their arrow starts to move, but quickly comes to a halt near the gap in the foot of the hills. The Hampshires continue to advance, but they have 10 miles of hills to get through. We are ordered to move up behind the Americans. Just as we are getting ready, the first column of German prisoners comes back. 50 tired men. Everyone rushes to look at this soon-to-be-familiar sight. Then we move up along the tracks. Great clouds of dust are thrown up as the tanks move forward. Engineers with bulldozers are working feverishly on the worst places in the roads. We pass Trotzer, and on our left we see Pichon, occupied in the early dawn. Now we're in a wide, flat valley, and we form up in open formation. That takes time, and it's 2 p.m. before we follow on behind the tank reconnaissance squadron. We can get no information from the Americans, so we advance bound by bound. We come to a wide sandfield wadi, which we start across, but the sand on the far side is so soft that we cannot get out. The wind has risen to a fury, and clouds of sand whip into our eyes. Now I go off in a carrier and at last find a proper crossing. We collect the rest of the company and haul and push all the trucks over. Now we're nearing the hills, working between scattered clumps of bushes. Odd parties of Americans pop up here and there. The leading tanks report coming under heavy mortar fire. Now they're nearly up to the gap. The leading tank reports that it is approaching 3 knocked out American Grants. Then silence and another voice breaks in. Bill's tank on fire, hit by mortars. No, they've got a second one too. Must be anti-tank guns, but I can't see where. No fire is from the hills on the left. The tanks stop hills. We can see the flash of American artillery and some cactus groves on the right. The hills are wreathed in smoke, but much more is coming back at us. The tanks disappear continually in the smoke of the bursts. James Booth, my company commander, is called up to the leading tank for orders. It is getting dusk, and soon all platoon commanders are summoned along with me. We go to the colonel's tank, with its skull and crossbones flag flying on the aerial. James is on a knoll nearby. He gives out orders amid a hail of shells, which are very distracting. As soon as it gets dark, I am to harbour the company in the midst of the tanks, while Bobby Tesh and Ron Sturgis, my fellow lieutenants, are to take fighting patrols to locate the minefield and discover the enemy's outposts, since we cannot get any information from the Americans. The night is troubled. Shelling is frequent and tracer fire breaks out intermittently as the Germans open up on real or imaginary patrols. An intended American attack does not materialize. Dawn breaks just as our patrols come back. They have found the enemy minefield and wire and exchange shots with the outposts. We spread out as the light increases and the shelling intensifies. The Germans are in the hills around us looking down on the sitting targets. Luckily, they concentrate on the leading tanks on the edge of the final open stretch of plain. It is broad daylight and the first Stukas come flying over and go screaming down on the supply transport behind us. The sky is black with AK-AK fire and they pull out much too early and let go their bombs. One goes plunging on, smoking and flaming. an oily black cloud marks its head. James tells us that the hills will be cleared before we are launched into the attack. Then at 07:30 hours, a staff car flying a flag comes up and stops beside Bob Fairweather, our carrier platoon commander, and General Crocker gets out. He asks who is in command and tells Bob to fetch the 21st Lancers colonel. Hamilton Russell comes over from his tank and Crocker asks him why he is not getting on. He says that he has been told to wait until the minefield has been cleared and the hills captured. Crocker merely says the operation is behind time. We must force the gap. You will charge the pass and take the high ground beyond, whatever the cost, says Crocker, and gets in his car and drives off. The first we know is when James is summoned for orders, comes back and gives out his orders in his best Otto style. Information. The enemy, estimated 5 battalions, holds the high ground on either side. He has plentiful artillery support, and the gap is covered by a number of unspotted anti-tank guns. There is an extensive minefield across the whole front, and roughly 1/4 of a mile to 1/2 mile deep. Intention, we will charge the gap and occupy the high ground, 3 pimples you can just see through the gap, on the other side. Method, 1721st Regimental Group will charge the gap in box formation with the company in the middle of the tanks. The company will be ready to debus and help clear a gap through the minefield if necessary. Any questions? Just one. Where do we indent for our harps from Ron Sturgis? No one laughs, it's too near the truth. We all realise it's about as suicidal as the charge of the Light Brigade. The gap was only 700 yards wide, and even if the tanks get through, we will be easy meat in our trucks for the machine guns and mortars and guns on either side. It's like hearing a death sentence, and we struggle for some cheerful comment, but instead just wish each other luck. Before, we've been keeping low in our hastily dug slit trenches, but now we don't care and sit on the edge dangling our legs. I try to analyse my feelings and find that I'm not so frightened as I expected to be, only wishing it was all over quickly. Waiting for the order to come through to start the attack was reminiscent of the nervous minutes spent in dentist's waiting room. My thoughts keep drifting off, wondering what it's like for the Germans sitting up there in the hill. Suddenly I remember a jar of rum in my FWD, a four-wheeled drive, slightly armoured vehicle, and hand it round the men. Kent, the dispatch rider, one of the few quite fearless men in the company, tells me how glad he is the Americans are going to see just what we can do. His enthusiasm is infectious, and I can't help laughing at it. The long, tense wait ends as the yellow flag goes up, the signal to advance. I feel better as soon as the action starts and there's something to do. The trucks motor out from behind the bushes and we all form up behind the colonel's tank. The shelling intensifies as we wait for the tanks to start the attack. A carrier receives a direct hit and we go over to pull out the wounded. Now the tanks are lumbering forward and we start moving behind them. Everything opens up on us and the continuous crash of shells thuds in our ears. Mostly they fall in clusters of 4. 1, then 1, 2, 3, all close together. That starts a frantic game of hide and seek with death as we watch the first shell then swerve or back or in the hopes of dodging the next. We are driving close down, peering through the slits in the thin armour of our FWD. In the confined space, near misses set up a frightening concussion, slaving at one's eardrums. We are going slower now. Ahead I can see a tank on fire, but still rolling forward. The whole valley is filled with a burst of shells, yellow flame flaring briefly amid dirty white smoke. In a kaleidoscope of images, the attention switches from them to the mortar shells with their blue-black smoke and louder crump. to scared Americans looking up at us from their scrapes and waving to us to go away, to the lush green grass and clumps of yellow marigolds, to the menacing mountain and the invisible enemy in the background. Over the wireless we can hear the phlegmatic voice of the reconnaissance squadron commander. Five tanks knocked out now, 88 millimeter guns, I think, but I haven't spotted them. No, sorry, it's mines as well. Seven gone now. There doesn't seem any way through. Any further orders? Over. Hello, Fox. Keep trying, Fox. Over. Wilco, understand. Two seem to have got through. Don't know how or why. Hell, I've hit a mine myself. Shall we stay and engage targets or evacuate the crew? I'm under small arms fire. As we edge up behind the other tank squadrons, which attract most of the shelling, our carriers are ordered forward to help pick up crews from disabled tanks, many with their tracks blown off by mines. James's FWD is hit and put out of action. He comes over with the crew and crams into mine. Spent machine gun bullets patter down one side of the armour. We are ordered to withdraw 500 yards while the other squadrons of tank continue to probe for a way through. As we turn round, all the guns suddenly concentrate on our soft vehicles. We stop by the Sergeant Major's truck to give him orders. As we talk, a series of shattering explosions erupts, so close that the yellow smoke drifts between us and the acrid stench hangs in the air. Through the smoke, there is a startling change in the Sergeant Major's face, the fixed smile dissolving into shock and agony as he sinks to the ground. All in the truck he had just left have either been hit or killed. We get them out quickly and struggle with inadequate knowledge and inadequate field dressings to bind the wound. We wonder about using the morphine ampoules for the pain, but decide against it as they lie still and dazed. I send the dispatch rider back for a truck for them, but that gets a direct hit as it drives up. We signal everyone to lie down and on the ground. There is a better chance that way. The next few minutes are a nightmare. More get hit, and as fast as people go to their aid, they are themselves hit. We work feverishly, improvising bandages, loading wounded on trucks and sending them back. James was magnificent, and I shall always remember him emerging phoenix-like from the smoke of shells. How he survived, I don't know. Someone goes berserk and stands staring at the ground, shouting, "Look, there's blood, blood!" He jumps in a wrecked truck, and when we try to pull him out, he kicks and bites and starts smashing the windscreen with his fists, cutting them to the tendons. James smacks him over the head with a revolver to knock him out, and we put him on the nearest truck, speeding off to the dressing station. Now we've caught up with the wounded and have no more on our hands. We spread out and try to scrape holes. Only two or three trucks remain and our FWD. We wait for orders. One of our carrier sections, sent out on a do-or-die mission to the left, spots three anti-tank guns, and the corporal goes through a hail of fire to point them out to the tanks. The first few are sceptical, but finally one takes an interest and at last spots a gunner who keeps taking a shot and then popping back into his slit trench. The tanks open up and knock most of them out. We are getting an idea of the enemy position now, and artillery begin to give effective support. Bob Fairweather comes back to join us. His carrier early struck a mine, blowing the dead wireless operator 20 feet into the air and overturning on him and the driver. Imprisoned under the carrier, they found the unbroken thing was a bottle of whiskey. This soon went, and they dug themselves out, emerging to find themselves under fire from a nearby machine gun. They ran for it and flopped into a trench to find an American squatting there with a heavy machine gun. Bob inquired coldly why he had not fired back, to which the American replied, "Say, he might have noticed me." Very sound, but it made Bob's moustache bristle when he related. A sapper section comes up and we try to cover them lifting mines. They get one or two up, but within minutes, several have been picked off by snipers, so they have to give up. The tanks are trying further along. At last the troops finds a gap in a wadi and breaks through, knocking out some guns. The other two regiments are ordered up and pass through the gap. Only we can get the heights on one side, we are through. The Americans attack again, but it never gets going at all. The guards are called up and a battalion of the Welsh guards go into the attack. It's a sight I'll never forget. They advance as if on parade in perfect order up the hill, creek, steep, craggy slope. They use smoke to great effect, but a hail of fire meets them. Gaps are torn in their lines, but the rest go on. Now they are doubling and you can hear them cheer above the bursting shells. Then it's all over and the lines...